This audio file featuring Andy Crouch was recorded at the 2008 Graduate Faculty Ministry National Staff Meeting.
I'm going to adjust my pedagogical style for this last session and read a little more than I have been in order to make my presentation more information dense. To get through a number of thoughts that I think might be helpful to us as we move from this overview of culture and of our posture towards culture into considering how this might shape our work on campus. So I want to go back, first of all, to these six postures that we covered yesterday, and just give you some of my own reflections on what these postures look like when they're embodied, for better and for worse, in Christian communities in the midst of the university. And I should say that as the next 30 minutes go on, my thoughts will get more and more incomplete and tentative as they get fresher and newer. And so more and more what I'm going to be saying to you and inviting you to be in conversation with me about is material that I'm really still wrestling with and working through in light of what I feel like we are learning about culture as Christians. So please take these as first-pass thoughts that are designed to provoke better thinking from somebody else, and maybe one of the somebody else's is you. So what about these six postures, condemning, critiquing, copying, consuming, all of which, as we said, can be appropriate gestures, but what do these postures look like when they're embodied in Christian communities? Well, in one sense, none of our students or fellowships really embody this first posture, the fundamentalist posture of withdrawal and double separation from the world, or else we wouldn't be in the university. So, in a way, this is the one that probably seems least relevant or least a risk for us and for our communities. At the same time, while by definition we and our students have not withdrawn from all contact with the secular university, is it possible that our communities from time to time tacitly endorse a complete separation in practice between the sacred and the secular, becoming places where the actual work that our students and faculty are doing is simply never referenced, is simply omitted when we pay attention to what we call spiritual things or spiritual matters? So this isn't, strictly speaking, a total condemnation of culture, but it's a kind of a willful ignoring of the cultural calling that our students and faculty engage in. And I do feel like I have been in more than one fellowship setting on campus, some of them sponsored by university, some of them not, where the attentions of students, while they were with one another in Christian fellowship, never moved to, never focused on their actual cultural calling, but stayed at the more familiar level of kind of personal issues of spiritual formation, relationship issues, you know, lots of good things that people need to sort through and pray through, but in which Bible study always stayed at this kind of spiritualized level of abstraction and never touched down into what we were actually living and doing. Is it possible for us to see our academic disciplines as locations for discipleship, or are our disciplines distraction? And I think that to the extent that our fellowships model a posture where work is sort of implicitly thought of as a distraction from real spiritual life, that we do share a certain amount of that separatist posture with the fundamentalists, except it's really more of a compartmentalized posture where one never touches the other. Still, I don't think, this is not my primary experience of graduate fellowships in particular, especially those that InterVarsity is involved with, though we always have to deal with the fact that our new generations of leaders may very well come in with these presuppositions right from the get-go. I think what is much more a occupational hazard for us is this second posture, becoming experts at critique. This often takes the form, and here I'm going to slaughter or at least inflict alarming wounds on a sacred cow, but often takes the form of what is called worldview analysis, which absorbs, in my experience, in and outside of this ministry, a tremendous amount of time and energy, largely because it is so fun for people who are sort of philosophically and analytically inclined. And there's a lot of it to be done. I mean, the question of the worldviews presupposed by the academy as a whole and by the particular disciplines within it are fascinating questions. They deserve careful and deep attention. And so we can devote a lot of our time and our time with our students to simply critiquing the worldview of the university that we find ourselves in or the discipline that they find ourselves in. And we can construct whole conferences and books and websites and weekends that really are designed simply to very thoroughly and carefully analyze the world of the university and the worldview of the university. The problem is that if that's our posture, we are participating in one of the characteristic, I think, weaknesses of the posture of the university as a whole, which is what I've come to call the academic fallacy, which is the idea that once you've understood something, you're done. Or even stronger, once you've understood something, you've changed it. Which is not true, alas, for all the writers of the many books that fill our university libraries. Mere analysis of the horizons of the horizons of possibility leaves them unchanged. Mere analysis. If you stop once you've understood it, you have not yet changed it. And perhaps you have not yet fulfilled your responsibility to your neighbor who lives within these horizons that you have so effectively critiqued, for better and for worse. Now, this is not to say that some of us aren't called very specifically to create works of cultural analysis. At least I really hope that that's not the implication, because that's a lot of what I do with my life and time. But works of analysis, whether they're in print or in the form of a conference or a talk or what have you, remain inert unless they are part of a larger process of cultivation and creation. And it's my experience that we always gesture, if you will, towards this reality when we talk about worldview. We say the point of thinking about worldview is to live out the Christian worldview. But in practice, I'm thinking of one very thick, well-written book on worldview in particular, in which the section that's titled Living It Out, which is about the sort of embodiment and practice of the worldview, takes up 21 pages out of 480. And the previous 459 pages are simply analysis of how to think about worldview. Now, again, as a single cultural product, that might be very much what that particular author was called to create. But unless it's part of a larger story where we actually become cultivators and creators, very little will change. And we may not have fulfilled our real responsibility. So are our fellowships simply places where people become very expert in critique? Or can we move beyond that posture? What about the posture of copying? I think this is also a risk for our campus fellowships, because what we can do in our fellowships is to copy the culture of our campus and import, remember what the copying posture did in the world of music was to import almost with perfect fidelity the form of culture, and then just sort of substitute some new content. And we can do that too. We import the style of discourse in the academic world into our fellowship experiences, the style of argument, the way that points are made and points are scored. We can bring in speakers who kind of imitate the discourse of the academy, but just do it in a Christian frame and, as a corollary, do it primarily or exclusively for one another, for Christians. So that we've replicated perhaps a very intellectually sophisticated apparatus of cultural life, but it only addresses issues of Christian content and only reaches people who already share our Christian faith. And I think that that is what copying as a posture looks like when it happens on campus. And I'm afraid that this does happen sometimes. How many sacred cows have I killed off so far? Again, all these could be appropriate gestures, but if it becomes a posture, the problem with copying is it grants too much to the culture in its adherence to cultural forms. Remember how somebody said yesterday, or actually to the evening before, that it was the way that the book Blueberries for Sale was written, not the content, that so altered their horizons. Forms have horizons as well as content having horizons. And so if we just allow the form of the university, if we take that for granted and just kind of refill it with Christian content, we aren't addressing the way in which the very form the university takes shapes horizons of possibility for better and for worse, and often for worse. In fact, I would say the form rather than the content is most often what shapes the horizons of possibility. So that the calling for us is to less slavishly imitate the form and more creatively engage the university as a whole. And this is why I love what John said last night about following Christ. We're going to take the form of a conference, which is an academic form, but we don't leave that form just sort of unexamined and just put Christian speakers in it. We think about, well, which parts of this form are helpful in their horizons, and which parts really leave out human experience that needs to be included. So that a conference like Following Christ always has to ask, and fortunately is asking, how to shape an experience whose horizons are closer to shalom than the experience you'd have at AAR, just a little more orthodox. Right? Can I get a witness? Finally, the posture of consumption. Often, we do simply consume the culture of the campus, and so our students are just as busy as other students. Our faculty count success the same way that other faculty count success. They count what is valuable research the same way that their colleagues do. So that when we live as consumers of culture, our life as a fellowship never kind of takes a trek out to the edge of the horizon. I sometimes think of the horizon as the sort of ring of mountains within it which a cultural group lives. And it's like we just stay all the way down in the valley, never asking, is there something at the edge that could be different if we lived a different way? And just by the nature of human being, I think it's very natural just to live in the bottom of the valley. And our fellowships can do that as well. These may all be legitimate gestures, and there's moments for each of them. But they're not what our communities are meant to be. They're meant to be communities that cultivate and create. So what would that mean? What does that look like? Well, let's first think about the posture of cultivation. Do we talk, in the context of our fellowships, about what in the university is good and how to keep it good? Or are we always strategizing for change?
This audio file featuring Andy Crouch was recorded at the 2008 Graduate Faculty Ministry National Staff Meeting.
Does the university, as a cultural entity, think of us as people who are for it in its goodness, or simply as people who are constantly attempting to subvert it and change it into their image of what it should be like? Do we talk with students about the essential goodness of simply becoming fluent in their own chosen discipline? Or do we sometimes prematurely press them to adopt the posture of critique toward their discipline's worldview before they have even become adept in their discipline's history and present reality? Do we take a first-year graduate student and say, all right, well, now you need to start, you know, thinking about what you're going to create that's going to be different? Well, that may be very premature. To ask a different kind of question, you know, the three kind of components often instead of academic evaluation are research, teaching, and service to the institution. And they are important in that order. And the third one is the one that faculty always most resent and neglect. So do our faculty approach the third leg of the academic stool, service to the institution, with the same attitude of benign or not so benign neglect as their colleagues, or as a genuine opportunity to preserve what's good within the university? Do we become known as people who serve the university exceptionally well? Of course, not everything is good in the university, and that's part of cultivating, of course, is to figure out what the weeds are. But one of the things that most clearly is not good about the university is its pervasive culture of critique, which alternates unsteadily and unevenly with sometimes messianic delusions about its role as a guardian of truth and knowledge. Do we model a more hopeful posture that is both willing to forthrightly acknowledge the weeds in the university's garden while also demonstrating that we want to serve the good of the university? And perhaps most importantly, are we willing to collaborate with other actors in the university, the administration, the faculty, other student groups, to cultivate the culture there? Or do we kind of insist that anything we might do for the good of the university has to be exclusively owned by our fellowship or by our Christian community? Are we willing to be partners in doing things that serve the good of the university where we may only get, you know, 1/8 of the credit line or 1/80th? This is something that I think of some recent iterations of the Veritas Forum that I think has been done better and better by the Veritas Forum, that started out as coalitions almost always, I think, of student groups. But increasingly, when I see advertisements for the Veritas Forum, I see co-sponsorships with departments, with the Atheist Society, with the Buddhist Society. And this is when we start to actually be cultivating within the world, the culture of the university as a whole. I think it's a great model. So once we've become well-known, and not just known, but truly become cultivators of what's good, do we then see ourselves as creators within the culture of the university? Are our fellowships spending time brainstorming together for opportunities to offer something new that might move the horizons for the public world of the university in public, not just in private or off campus or at a special event? And are we collaborating with others on campus who might want to be our partners in creating something new? One of the things that has become very important to me in thinking about cultural goods is the recognition that they're always created by networks. They're never created by individuals. By the definition of culture, they have to be shared and they have to be formed collectively. They're never private. And the question of who is in the creative circle that shapes a cultural good is a very good index to which culture that good will ultimately affect. We know this, right? We've learned this. We're still learning it in InterVarsity in the case of multi-ethnicity, right? If we say we want to be multi-ethnic, but no one from a given ethnic community is included in the shaping of the goods that we offer, how likely is it, really, that what we offer will in any meaningful way be multi-ethnic? Not very likely. Likewise, if only Christians are involved in the creation of a cultural good, if our fellowships do not learn how to partner with other creative communities within the university in the creation of events, activities, forms of residential life, new classes, new departments, new institutes, it is exceedingly unlikely that the cultural goods that result will have any effect on the horizons of the university at large. Cultivating and creating, then, are going to require us to stretch ourselves into new kinds of partnerships that have not been very familiar or practiced by evangelical Protestants. And I would definitely include myself in that group. A few years ago, just to give an example of this, an acquaintance of mine was doing his residency in internal medicine at the University of Indiana, or some medical school in Indiana. Some of you probably know the right name. And he realized that the structures, the form of residency at this particular institution had horizons that were really wrenched out of place and did not contribute to human flourishing. Students and faculty alike were stretched and stressed to the limit by an impossibly demanding and convoluted schedule of shifting responsibilities in the course of the week. There was very little time for the formation of real teaching relationships. And the care that was being delivered to patients was often disconnected from one shift to the next, from one day to the next, one week to the next. Now, Chris could have taken a posture of condemnation, critique, or mere consumption, simply going along with the flow. He could have just hunkered down and survived the experience like a lot of folks do, sometimes by necessity. But he had just been to a Christian conference that had expanded his own horizons of his imagination to include the possibility that Christians could be the agents of change to create more livable human communities. That had been the focus of the conference. So he got together with another resident who was not a Christian, and who also, by the way, was of a different race, and worked out a proposal to the faculty for quite radically reworking the training schedule of their residency. And to their astonishment, the faculty, who had showed very little interest in most student initiatives, actually took them up on their proposal. And the next year, they were asked to be co-chief residents, a form that had never, there had always just been one chief resident, but because of their shared leadership, they were asked to be co-chief residents the next year and lead the implementation of this change in the way that students were trained. Now, Chris has long since left that residency program. He's a doctor in private practice now. But as far as I know, the horizons are still different for every succeeding generation of students and faculty in that program because of his cultural creativity. Are our fellowships nurturing and supporting people like Chris and celebrating them? Do we tell these stories? I think the answer is yes, but I think we could do more. Now, let me just mention, this doesn't just apply to the world of university, right? It applies to a cultural institution like GFM. What do we do within our own organization when we're faced with horizons that we find misplaced? We can drop out, which is the fundamentalist option. We can critique. You can sit on the bus and talk about what's wrong. You can copy. You could go start your own campus ministry, like take the same form, but just do it your way. Or you can consume. You can just go along with the flow, right? These are all options that people take in response within their own organizations. Or we can become cultivators. This is the step people always skip. We always want to jump to what we're going to change when we finally have the power. But so often what we need to start with is, how can I keep what is good, good? And then, having become known as cultivators, as someone who's in it for the good of the organization, we can propose a new cultural good. We may have to start small. It may be very incremental. But I've become, in my own life, very impatient with my own tendency to just criticize the culture of the institutions I've been involved in without asking the question, is there some small thing I could create in partnership with other people that might make some incremental difference, just might move the horizons a little bit in the direction that I feel like I've been given a vision for? This is how organizations grow and how cultures change. I have come to deeply believe that the only way cultures change is through the introduction of new cultural goods. I can't prove that to you today. If we had another week, I could make my argument. I've become convinced of this. Condemning and withdrawing will not change anything. Critique by itself will not change anything. Consumption and going along with the flow will not change anything. The only thing that changes the culture of a university, of intervarsity, of something as small as our families or as large as our shared dominant culture in North America is the creation of new goods. It's the only way it happens. Well, that was all supposed to be in last night's talk, so I'm now going to give you a 10-minute version of today's talk. But fortunately, it's also tentative and complicated, and probably three-quarters of it are wrong, I think it's not bad. This raises, then, the question, how do you know that the cultural good you seek to create will, in fact, take hold? What if you fail? And that raises the question of what I've come to call cultural power. This is the hardest thing to come directly to terms with when we talk about culture, and about culture making in particular, that when we talk about the creation of new cultural goods, we cannot avoid the issue of cultural power. Here's my working definition for cultural power. And it's, you'll see it's a kind of a self-defining definition, and probably some of the philosophers could tease it apart, but I think it is heuristically helpful anyway. My definition of cultural power is simply the ability to successfully propose a new cultural good. You know you have cultural power when you offer something up in a cultural sphere, as small as a family, or as large as a ministry of 110 people, or as large as a university of 60,000 people, and it actually takes root and becomes a public shared good that other people start to make something of themselves and make something with. That's what cultural power is. Now, in our own families, let's just drill down to that smallest unit of culture, the family, we know that our power is limited. Those of us who are parents have attempted to propose certain new dishes to be eaten at dinner or supper. And we find that even given our tremendous resources of additional strength, height, intelligence, experience, wisdom, we sometimes cannot successfully propose that our children start eating mushrooms or, you know, what have you, right? So even within the family, even in an environment where parents have a great deal of coercive power, we do not always have cultural power. And in my family, we're probably at about a 2/3 success rate with new dishes. But at least 1/3 of the time, there's just an absolute no. So cultural power is different from coercive power, or what Joseph Nye has called hard power. If you have hard power, which is essentially backed by the threat of force, not that that ever happens in our house, you can get people to do things they do not want to do. And that means you can move the horizons of possibility in dramatic ways by the exercise of coercive or hard power. But hard power can never create. It can only limit or destroy. A gun is a very powerful thing. Yet it is also amazingly inert as a cultural, an agent of culture. Once the guns have stopped firing, even if your side won the fight, there is less than there was before. Always less, never more. Weapons are subtractive, not additive. And that's true of all forms of coercive power. They can limit, they can subtract, but they can never add. Now, we could have a lively debate about whether one should ever use hard power to try to limit the damage to the horizons of human possibility. That's the pacifist argument. But even the most ardent proponents of just war would agree that war cannot create culture. War cannot, as Isaiah says, rebuild the ruins. After the war, cultural power, the ability to successfully propose new cultural goods, will have to be exercised. And new cultural goods, because of the public nature of culture, can only be proposed, not imposed. The cultural goods that shape our horizons are not within any of our grasp to impose on another. They require a kind of tacit consensus. And this is true even of what we often associate with hard power, like military command, which in fact is based on soft power, because the general often doesn't even have a single gun in his possession. He relies on his ability to persuade others. All the more, the creation of a cultural good like a building or a new book or a new conference or a new department within a university can only be proposed, and then you see whether people take you up on it. And sometimes they don't. Now, here's the punchline for this group. The reason our students are at the university is to acquire cultural power. That's why they pay to come, or someone else pays for them to come, to acquire the ability to successfully propose new cultural goods. They're in school to acquire fluency in a particular cultural domain and to become cultivators and creators in that domain. This is not just true in the business school or, you know, the professional schools. It's true in every department. Because what education does is it opens up new dimensions of freedom within which we become able to propose new cultural goods. It's about cultural power. It's for the development of cultural power. How do we feel about that? My sense is that Christians have a tremendous ambivalence toward power, even soft power. We rarely talk about it. And when we do talk about it, it's often in negative terms. It's often about the abuse of power, the unjust use of power. And there are some reasons to be negative about power, and I want to get to that in a minute, but let me just, first of all, make the case for the goodness of power, of cultural power I'm talking about, not coercive. We can save that for the Just War Conference next year. And let me just put it very simply, because I have to condense this part of my talk. When God grants Adam the freedom to name the animals. What is that but God giving Adam cultural power, the ability to successfully propose a new cultural good? Indeed, if we can accurately call cultural artifacts cultural goods, then the creation of cultural goods is good, often good. So we have to start with power the same way we start with the other two great temptations, areas of temptation and possibility in the Christian life, sex and money, right? Sex, money, and power are the big three. And they all begin with something good, something created and good. So why are we ambivalent and tend to be negative about power? Well, I want to call attention to something about power that distinguishes it from sex and money in a quite dramatic way. And that's power's instability. Two things you need to absorb about power. The first is, no one ever knows how much they have. How do I know when I come to this conference to propose a new cultural good, a set of vocabulary, a way of talking about culture, that you guys will take it up and it'll become part of our shared vocabulary and maybe you'll go and teach it to someone else? Well, I don't know. I don't know coming into this meeting. I mean, I can guess, I can kind of handicap the odds, but I don't know. No one ever knows how much power they have. You don't know until you try. And most people who engage in a lifetime of proposing cultural goods fail a lot of the time. The other corollary, in a way, is that no one ever has enough. Now, you can have enough money. You can have so much money that your problem becomes how in the world to get rid of it without doing more harm than good. And you can have enough sex. Might be a lot, but there's some point at which anyone would be satiated. All right? By the way, also with money and sex, you know how much you have, right? How much you're having. You can count your money, and you know, if you're having sex or not. But no one knows how much power they have, and no one ever has enough power. Why? Because their horizons are so wrong that any awake and aware human being would want to move them and create enough cultural goods to move their horizons toward God's shalom, but no one ever can do that. So Bill Gates has more money than he can easily know what to do with, and let's presume that he has a happy married life. But Bill Gates never can wake up and say in the morning, I have enough power to accomplish even just the subset of cultural goods that I feel called to create in the world. He doesn't have enough. Well, what does this mean? It means that power is uniquely tempting. Of all three, it's the most insidious. Because if you never know how much you have and never have enough, what are you tempted to do? You're tempted to try to accumulate it by any means possible. Try to store it up. Try to get some more just in case you need to spend it on something. And this leads to what I sometimes call the fallacy of strategy, which is that we can strategize our way into being able to successfully propose a new cultural good if we just kind of build the right alliances and find the right powerful partners. And for an example of how amazingly, totally this does not work, the religious right is just an amazing case study from our own lifetimes. Starting with the premise that to change American culture, we need power in American culture, but that we don't have enough because we're not actually as big a majority as we'd like to think we are. So we build alliances with other people who also have power, enter into all these kind of shady deals, and at the end of the day find ourselves not having changed half of what we expected to, but having been changed twice as much or 20 times as much as we expected to be changed ourselves. It came out of that instability of power and that temptation then to just accumulate it. Well, what's a Christian posture toward this? I think it begins by identifying the truth from the Christian point of view about power. And I'm so glad we studied Isaiah 61 this morning because it did this part of the talk for us if we have ears to hear. The truth is that God is at work in culture and God has cultural power. Now, this is not something that is necessarily immediately accessible to us or easy to believe. In fact, it is kind of the ultimate question of faith. Do we believe that God is at work in human cultures? But what God says in Isaiah 61, in essence, is what you failed to do to create righteousness and justice and a community of praise in the midst of human cultures, I am going to do for you. You, Israel, arrived in the exile at a place of utter cultural powerlessness. But I am going to step into your story and bring my power alongside yours in a way that will restore your capacity, that will rebuild the ruined habitations, that will lead to a new kind of clothing, a new kind of garden, all those cultural images. God says, I am going to do that. In fact, I've come to believe that the good news to the oppressed, or the good news to the poor, is that they are not as poor as they think they are. The two essential events of the Christian story, the Jewish and Christian story, are the Exodus and resurrection. And what are these two events but God stepping into a place of utter powerlessness and bringing his power alongside people, so that the message to the poor is not, I'm powerful and I need to come help you because you need some of my power. It's God is with you to create something even in the midst of your constraints. You too, even the poorest of the poor, can be an agent of cultural creativity and change. So what does this mean for our students? Very, very briefly, in 1 minute. My goodness, I have no idea. No. We can talk about it. But I think it means we need to cultivate two disciplines in them. And to, again, this is so much beginning for me. I feel like I'm just learning about this, and we need to learn about it. But I think there are two disciplines that they and we can cultivate to help deal with the temptation of cultural power. The first is service, which is taking up the posture of a servant who is a person who takes orders rather than gives orders and implements others' cultural power rather than implementing their own. And the key ingredients of service, I think, are anonymity and invisibility. Stepping outside the place where we have power and serving someone who may never know our name. But if that's all, I don't think that's enough. I think the other is stewardship, which is someone who consciously has cultural power, but invests it alongside those who seem to the world to be powerless, but in fact, thanks to God's reversals in history, has more power available to them than we could ever imagine. And if we practice these disciplines, we may become the kind of people who can cultivate and create powerfully and also righteously and justly in the midst of the university and in the midst of our world. So with that, I will stop, and we will have a conversation for about 15 minutes or 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes, depending on how good the conversation is. Yes.
I really have two questions. I think the first one is short. Your example, the medical, your medical example, said that we often don't know the power we have. And in your example, I don't understand where they got their power. And so if you speak to that. And then the second question is, can you help flesh out some of these ideas with some scripture, some narrative, where we know this has already happened in the big story?
Yes, yes. On the question of where did they get the power to propose that new cultural good, of a new way of training. Well, that's a very good question, and it's quite mysterious, I would say. And there's something very mysterious about cultural power. We often don't know. You don't know until you try. And it could easily have been otherwise. There are many reasons the faculty could have said, no, we're not interested. There's a profound mystery as to why some cultural goods get proposed and take root and others don't, and I'm not sure I could answer that. I mean, I could tell, I sometimes distinguish between necessary and sufficient conditions. It's necessary that your proposal be well-formed, that they had thought through it, that they were articulate, and that they'd done hard work already, but those are not sufficient. You could never have sufficient conditions. There were many ways it could have gone wrong. What is the scriptural narrative that grounds us in this? Well, I very briefly kind of adverted to it, but I really think Exodus and Resurrection, they're the linchpin of the two testaments of the Bible, and they are the place where power is addressed most directly. Because let's just take the Resurrection because it's the more stark and surprising of the two. In the Resurrection, God incarnate, with presumably all the cultural power necessary to do whatever he wants, chooses to abandon his power. Jesus abandons his power in trust of the Father. And at that moment of radical powerlessness, Saturday night, God the Father steps in and with his power raises Jesus from the dead in what I believe is the most culturally significant event in history, literally. The most measurable cultural effects in history come from the resurrection of Jesus. So it's very important that we allow our sort of picture of power to be schooled by these two stories. Schooled by the story of the Exodus, with all its precursors, Joseph getting a lot of power, but then getting dashed from power, and its echo in the exile. The Exodus is sort of echoed in the exile. So Exodus, exile, and then Jesus' death and resurrection are where we go to learn about how to narrate our own engagement with power. Other comments, questions? Doesn't just have to be about the last bit, but anything that came up. Yeah, Randy.
I like your playing with the image of cultivation. But I sense a little bit in what you're doing, and more so in what we all tend to do. A use of cultivation that sort of jumps over the initial meaning of cultivation. We take the word, we skip the agrarian roots of it,
yes,
and jump over to human making,
yes,
we want to make. The difference with natural garden cultivation is it doesn't matter how much you do it, it doesn't matter how well you do it, it's still going to take 3 months or so.
Yes, right.
It's still a training in patience, reliance on God, reliance on the weather. We tend to want to make it quickly into a human making that is much less predictable.
Yes. Well, I agree. I think you're right. And, you know, one of the mysteries of the providence of God is why did the incarnation happen in a largely agrarian context rather than a technological context? And I think part of the answer is that as we receive the story of Scripture in a technological context, we are forced to recall the agrarian underpinnings and the natural realities of life, a life without technology, life without anesthesia. And so it even as it comes into the modern world, it challenges us to relearn that kind of patience in culture. Yeah. And humility, I would say. Yeah, Kelly.
We make sense by making stuff. We make sense by making stuff. Don't we also make stuff by making sense? I mean, would Bach have, you know, would we have a B minor mass or a St. Matthew's Passion or Sistine Chapel? Is there living in a great big story and that inspired this stuff to make?
It is. It's both and, because it's a continual process. The way Peter Berger describes it is every human society is an enterprise of world building. And the world isn't just the stuff. It's the sense that the stuff makes. And within that, then people make more stuff. The important thing, though, is never to allow the idea level or the value level or the conceptual level of culture to get divorced from the actual tangible goods, because they are always the mediators of it. But yes, they carry sense with them. And that sense informs what the next generation makes. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, there's an argument, for example, to be made that out of the Reformation came this huge increase in productivity that sort of, you know, fueled America. And my neighbor in Ohio is an economist who's not a believer, but I have a very interesting conversation about this, that the fuel was gratitude and not the work ethic was out of gratitude for what Christ did for us, not my trying to earn my salvation. And that there's a relationship between that ontology and that level of productivity and creativity.
Yes. Another example, and this is a book that I would really recommend for use with your students and that influenced my own thinking about this, is The Rise of Christianity by Rodney Stark, which I can't go into the argument of it right now, but at the end he says something very interesting. He says, sociologists have been very attentive and historians have been very attentive to how social factors shaped religious doctrines, right? We've gotten really good at all that stuff. But the interesting thing he says in a book that's very much about social factors, is he says, we haven't paid enough attention to the central role that doctrines played in shaping social forms. So there's this, it's not one or the other. It's this constant iterative process in which the way people conceive of their world shapes what they can make. And so that's why the imagination and ideas are just as important. But until they're instantiated in stuff, they don't shape anything. Yeah. Yes?
Your idea of cultural power has a lot of resonance with, I think, a sociologist's idea of cultural capital.
It's pretty much the same.
Okay. So I'm wondering, as our graduate students are involved in this accumulation of cultural power or capital in the university, that I'm curious how we talk about not only their stewardship and their service, but also their transition in class. They move from, you know, what might be a working class family now through their education into an upper class, even if their economic capital doesn't go along with. How do we talk about that with our students and deal with the whole class thing?
What a great question. Well, one angle on it is that one of the broken horizons of the university is that the university, to some extent explicitly, was designed to separate people from their own story and from their roots. And it seems to me that one function of Christian fellowship, of participation in the whole body of Christ in the midst of the university, is to keep people connected to the whole fellowship of saints, not all of whom are upper middle class, not all of whom have college education, let alone graduate education. And so our job as ministers of the gospel is to keep people literally and figuratively, that is, in actual relationships and in the way they conceive themselves and their identity, in relationship with people who aren't like us, but who have something very important to teach us, and who, because God is on the side of the poor, have access to cultural power that we don't have. And to reframe who those people are in a way that the university never will, because it would so undermine its own kind of assumptions. Yeah, Howard.
Hard power. Go back to that for a second. You said it never creates, it only limits and destroys. So when I think of God in the Old Testament using weapons, I think he used hard power. Did he create something or only limit and destroy?
Well, this, of course, is the question of whether war can be, in a certain sense, good. In other words, can war hold back or restrain that which constricts human possibility in a way that makes space for cultural creativity? And the Augustinian answer is yes, and the pacifist answer is no, and they both have really good arguments. One thing the Augustinian answer has on its side, biblically, is that God is represented in the Bible as using hard power to make space, though, not just to kind of mess things up, full stop, but to create something in a place that otherwise would be overrun by evil, really. And, of course, how we apply that now is a tough one. Okay, two more questions, and then we will stop. One more question. No more questions. Well, thank you all very much.